Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, award winners, up-and-comers, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner, an elementary school librarian, author of the Busy Librarian blog, and your host. This is episode number 171 with Russ Cox, author and illustrator of Faraway Friends, which is published by Sky Pony Press. Russ helps moderate the weekly KidLit Art Chat on Twitter, which I've been known to frequent. Actually, I've made a whole bunch of friends there just from hopping on to admire the art and works in progress shared each week. Getting to talk to Russ without the limitation of 140 characters was a real treat, and I hope you enjoy a whole lot as well. Here is episode number 171 of the podcast with Russ Cox. Let's get busy. Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, Russ Cox. I'm glad that we're finally talking.
Yeah, finally. I mean, how long have we been talking on Facebook and Twitter?
I mean, I've seen the birth of Faraway Friends. It's been neat to see sort of, I mean, you were writing it long before I knew you, but to see it, to see your final work on it, to see the initial copies come in for it, the art or the FNGs, the arcs of it. And then to see it out in the world is just, it's cool. And to see you like getting ready for promotional stuff and all of that. It's been really fun to enjoy that process through watching you.
Yeah, it's been quite the roller coaster, especially the last few years, you know, from getting an agent to getting the book deal to putting the book together. And now the book's out, and now the roller coaster really hits because all the promotion and book events. And
yeah.
And I finally get a break and get to do something relaxing like this.
Yeah, well, no doubt. Obviously, you get a break because I get a break because school's out. I guess the summer is your time for book festivals, though. But yeah, the school visits, well, maybe you're even, I know over the summer we make plans. So you might be already getting those school visits lined up and thinking about what it'll be like to do Faraway Friends with some more kids. But I'm thankful that I got a chance to read it. I felt like, I'm going to just be candid with you and say, I felt like you and I both are probably still grown-up little boys. And this felt like a book that you were just tapping into your childhood. Like, it just sort of felt like a natural story in that way. But I love that, and I'll give you an opportunity just to sort of give the synopsis of the book. But I love in Faraway Friends the way that you are just so genuinely tapping into the childhood experience. And I think as an adult reading to my child, also a lot of that creativity and interest in the beyond and the unknown that I still have as an adult. So why don't I give you a second just to share with the listening audience what Faraway Friends is all about?
Well, Faraway Friends is about a little boy named Sheldon who has in his head that his best friend moved away to Jupiter, and he gets that impression through the Jupiter Moving Company truck that shows up to move his friend. So Sheldon, being a big outer space astronaut buff, comes up with this plan to build his own spaceship. So he and his dog Jet, they come up with these plans, they build this spaceship, and then they blast off on this journey to find their friend. Only to realize that their spaceship really wasn't quite up to snuff. And So while this was happening, this alien creature moves next door, and the alien creature has his own little spaceship, and he comes over and helps Sheldon repair his spaceship, and they become friends, and they blast off on another space adventure.
And it's the way that you go into Sheldon's imagination and out of it is sort of that, like, snapping back into reality. I love that. Yeah, the feeling of, like, you do lose yourself in play. It's a thing that I hope every single person listening has had that experience or can remember losing yourself, where a cardboard box and a trash can and a wagon become a rocket ship or whatever. And then there is that moment where you snap out of it and sort of have to take in what you're seeing. And when Ruben approaches, it's certainly that. It's what am I looking at? But to find a friend that can pick up in your play that way is so, I don't know. It was just a wonderful thing. I loved it.
Thank you. I think what the original idea, I wanted the book to be really funny, and it just kind of took a life of its own. And when I was done with it, I realized that it was a lot of my childhood experiences really came out in this book. I moved around a lot as a kid. My parents were in the textile business down south. So this was in the 70s. So the textile businesses were kind of closing left and right. So we kind of, you know, hopped from job to job.
You followed where the work was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I was always curious what, you know, I always left the place, but I made friends. It's like, I wonder what it was like for them to lose a friend, have a friend move away. And I never really experienced that. So I guess that's what kind of started coming out in the story. And plus when I lived in Tennessee, we built what was called coasters. We'd go to the junkyard, we'd find blocks of wood, lawnmower wheels or wagon wheels. And we'd build these race cars and we'd race them down the hill.
Oh, that's awesome.
So when you're racing a car, you know, you thought you were Richard Petty or Bobby Allison or Mario Andretti, all these race car drivers.
And so, like, Little Rascal style, you built these things, pushed them up to the top of the hill.
That's exactly what it is.
And then raced them down without helmets.
Yes. Yes. And I actually one time flipped the car down the hill. And my arm stuck out. Luckily, we were industrial enough to build a roof. So when it flipped, my arms were out because I had a rope steering it. So my arms were the only thing that I got caught, you know, cut up. But it was quite spectacular, according to the kids, when it flipped down the hill.
Nice.
But it was definitely Little Rascals-esque. That's great.
I love the way that when you impressing your friends can sort of heal your wounds and make things hurt a little less. If they think it's awesome, it's like, oh, I'm all right. Sort of.
Yeah, until my mother put the iodine or mercurochrome on the cuts. Then it wasn't. Then I snapped back to reality real quick. So. But the kids are like, that was awesome. Can you do it again? It's like, no.
Can you please tumble in your car down the road again? Ugh.
It's almost like most of the movie Parenthood with Keanu Reeves when he, at the end, he wrecked the dragster.
Yeah.
The promoter, can you do that every week? And he's like, I guess so.
Oh man. And yeah. Well, to know that was the childhood you grew up with, makes me feel even more excited about whatever more stories you're going to be tapping into to deliver to us. That is wonderful. Cause I think there's also, I mean, there's this thing where, and this is, I guess this is the universal adult experience where you're constantly talking to your kids about, well, when I was growing up, this is the thing we did. And I know that we all turned out okay, even though we're so protective of our children. But I'm going through that with my 4-year-old right now, or almost 5-year-old, where there's all of these things where I'm like, I remember doing this when I was a kid. I remember, you know, going up to the top of the hill and getting on a skateboard and not having the trucks be tight enough. So it would just like wobble crazy back and forth and just counting down in my head, when am I going to wipe out? Cause it is going to happen. I'm going to eat gravel any second.
Right.
But you always go like a little bit longer than you thought you would. And then you face plant. But it's that, like, how do I communicate how awesome childhood can be to my kid, but also remember to be safe.
Right. And, you know, when I grew up, we didn't have, you know, there weren't cable channels and, boy, I'm just probably aging myself here, but you know, we didn't have video games or any of that stuff. So we were outside always building something or digging holes or, you know, just dirt clod fights, just anything. just to amuse ourselves and you know, get out of our parents' hair for the day. So,
well, there you go. I mean, that's what builds those experiences that mm-hmm. hopefully churn up a lot of stories later, but also just they round you out as a person. I think of when our students now are reading, John Sheska has his autobiography is called Knucklehead. Have you read Knucklehead before?
No, I haven't read it.
It's great. You should read it. It's hilarious.
Okay.
But it's he grew up with four or five, I think it's five brothers, five Sheska brothers. And the way he describes playing all of these different games, I think like when I'm reading it, I'm going like, that is exactly what I used to do when I was a kid too. But mm-hmm. then I think, I wonder how much, because neighborhoods are different now and you can't, you know, your parents don't just say, get out of the house and play and come back when it's dark. They don't do that anymore.
No.
So, so I wonder when kids are reading it, what it's like. But it's such a good experience to share with them because, I don't know, because I see, again, drawing from my own experience, I see with my kid that, yes, he wants to look at the screen. He wants nothing more than to watch YouTube Kids. But it only takes me saying, hey, buddy, do you want to go outside and do whatever, and if mm-hmm. he has an invite to come play with me somewhere, then that screen it means nothing to him. He wants to get out. So maybe some of these kids just need that invitation, and maybe we're doing that through books, through sharing these experiences.
Yeah, I think you're right, and that's one thing that we saw when we moved to Maine. We live in a little town at Pittsfield, very very Americana. It's almost like you step back into the 50s in some ways. But at night during the summer, you hear kids playing tag and riding their bikes and yelling and having a great time. And it's like, wow, it's almost like a flashback to when I was a kid.
Well, that's great, though. That's great that community still exists and that's still something going on and it's safe for them and that it's whatever.
Yeah, it's kind of like everybody watches out for one another. You know, parents watch out for the other kids. Yeah. It's one of those, like, if you get in trouble,
oh,
you know, everybody
knows.
Everybody knows.
Takes a village, and this village is going to raise you.
Right.
And
they're willing to yell at you, too. So.
They're willing to yell at you, that's right. Yeah. No grocery store visit is safe. Everyone's right. Watching. There's eyes everywhere.
That's what it's like, because we live right next door to a grocery store, and you can tell the kids who's been in trouble, because everybody just kind of glares at them.
It's really fun. Man. Hey, going back to Faraway Friends,
okay.
It was making me think of it. I actually wanted to first go back and say, because I'm still on this, like, nature versus nurture versus childhood versus whatever. And I was going to say, my kid just inherently has always picked up straight objects and made them into things that make noise. For example, since he was 2 years old, every stick or whatever he picked up has been a leaf blower or a vacuum cleaner or a something like that. And he has used those words, and it's so loud when he was doing this long sustained white noise. And recently-ish, he has started calling sticks guns. So now we're playing the gun game, and mommy does not like the gun game. But it brings me back to that same thing where it was like, sticks were always guns. When were they not guns? And it made me actually realize too, that very recently he went with his granddad to up to Westminster, where they were doing a Civil War reenactment. And that was probably the first time he's ever actually seen guns being fired in a simulation in that way. But to see that, and I thought, you know, this is not a terrible thing that he's playing this out. It's another thing that he's understanding. And I wonder, again, how much that's just a thing that we learn to do. Like, I didn't train him to like guns or to like diggers or to like vacuum cleaners or leaf blowers. Right. And yet he just kind of does.
I know. I think it's a boy thing, because I did that. I mean, we would make guns out of sticks. And we actually had a friend who would actually carve guns out of balsa wood.
And dude, that's kind of awesome.
He was really good. So we'd take him out in the cornfield, the farmer's cornfield. And we'd have, we'd use the ear of corn as hand grenades. And, you know, if somebody looked out their window, they saw corn just flying back and forth.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then, you know, we just run around and you know, you pretend you shoot each other and all that. And but it was play. I mean, now I grew up where I don't like guns at all. And so I think you just kind of have to get it out of your system.
I think so too. I think it's play and playing sides. And I think more importantly, it's emphasizing rules. There's rules to games that we play, especially when we make them up. We're making up those rules. And so it's learning how to play in a world of rules. And everywhere the kid goes when they grow up is going to be nothing but being confronted with different rules for different, you know, situations where we behave. And I think that that's, I don't know, I think it's all good. I think it's shaping his character, actually.
Yeah, it's like the old Warner Brother cartoons, you know, where Wile E. Coyote would have an anvil drop on his head. Yeah, it's funny, but then you realize, well, look, he got hurt.
Yeah, no doubt.
So we didn't go out and start dropping anvils on each other. First of all, we couldn't pick him up.
He also spent a lot of money.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, I wonder who's bankrolling him. That was,
I mean, really?
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing, you know, I think... you kind of learn from by doing it, and then you realize that, you know, this is just make believe. And then as you get older, you realize that, you know, there are consequences to your actions.
Yeah.
And I think if you don't experience that as a kid, I think you can, you know, when you get older, you could be confused.
Oh, I think so too.
Yeah.
Hey, so Russ, I know that you've done, you share a lot of art, especially I know you're, I think maybe we first connected, I assume probably through the Thursday night Kidlit Art chat on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I think that's how it was. I know we also connected on Facebook and things like that. So I say this, that you share a lot of art online, as do many other illustrators. I know that because I see it a lot online. Is Faraway Friends the first book that you've published that you've written and illustrated? Because I know you've done illustrations for other books before.
Yeah, this is my first.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thank you. I tell you, it's really surreal. You know, I walk in a bookstore and there's a book that I did both.
Yeah.
It just kind of like, you know, somebody pinched me.
I mean, that's your story, not just your vision of how you interpret someone else's story, how you, you know, collaborate with them to make something, but that's you getting to play both roles and figure out what are the right, you know, strike the right balance between the words and the illustration to, communicate your story.
Yeah, it's and I tell you, the writing part of the story really scared me.
Did it really?
Oh yeah, yeah. Because I've never done it before.
Well, so you're an illustrator. Did you start then in this book? Did you start with illustration? Did you kind of not storyboard? I don't know what word to use, but did you work from illustration and build in words, or were you able to, I don't know, like walk away and just do a manuscript like you were used to being handed? For the other work you've done?
Well, this story actually started out with a doodle I did, and Debbie Ohi saw it.
Debbie saw it. I like her.
Yeah, Debbie saw it. Yeah, Debbie's great. She goes, you should write a story for that.
Oh, cool.
I was like, I can't write a story. I can barely write my name. You want me to write a story? She goes, no, I think you really should write a story. She's like, I don't. She goes, well, if you don't, I'm going to.
From your... Because she also was in, that was a very powerful sketch if she's also inspired by it.
Yeah. And because we were in a group called Pixel Shavings with Hazel Mitchell, Fred Kohler, and Sherry Barnes.
Oh, cool. This is a little critique group, was it online?
Yeah.
Or do you all live near each other?
It was an online thing that we put together, and it was just it's all kid lit. So we would share things and get critiques. So I just did the sketch and she saw it, and she goes, you really need to write the story. So it's like, okay. So I sat down and I wrote the story and I read it to my wife. And she's like, that's really bad. And she's great. I love her. She's very honest. She gives me open critiques. And, you know, that's what I want. And she goes, you know, you really should probably figure out what you're doing. And I really didn't. So I wrote a second draft. And I think the second draft was worse than the first draft. So I said, well, I better start doing research. So I went down to our local library and I was reading kids' books. And then I read Ann Whitford Paul's Writing Picture Books.
Okay. Yeah, I know that one.
Yeah. And after I read that, I'm like, now I have a better understanding of what I should be doing. And, you know, with the arc and development of the story. And so that really helped. And then, like, again, sitting down and just reading tons of picture books.
Yeah. I mean, that I feel like that's got to be one of the best ways to, I don't know, sort of set your compass on what is good is by reading a lot and knowing what you identify as good and then sort of deconstructing them and saying, well, what is it? What quality is it about this that I like? Is it in the way the words are paced or in the way that, I don't know, the language is figurative or descriptive, right. or I don't know.
And like with the picture book, which I didn't know until I started in all this reading and research, is that less is more, especially in the word department. And so that really kind of like, okay, all right, I have to go back and really start editing. You know, I was using a lot of adverbs and adjectives, which are kind of no-nos. And so once I did that, I'm like, oh, I get it now. And then I started sharing with some friends of mine. They helped critique the story, and they really kind of helped me put it together. Some great critiques. And then once I got an agent, she really helped me develop it even further, and we pushed it. And it just kind of developed from there. I mean, there were a lot of cooks in that kitchen, which, you know, I wished I had a 2 pages just to dedicate to everybody who helped out.
Well, your agent, this was another one of those fun things. It just, through this podcast, I'm starting to know people because I'm starting to be part of a different community. I know an awful lot of librarians because we, much like authors and illustrators, we primarily work alone. So we seek the connection and the community online. So I know lots of librarians. But I'm starting to know the Kidlit community. And so I know your agent. I know her really well. And I don't think I even realized that she was an agent until maybe even the point. Sorry, Danielle, I'm going to say this. I'm going to admit it. Maybe when you said, I'm represented by this person, I went, wait, that's got to be that person. That's got to be Danielle. So you're represented by Danielle Smith, by @thefirstdaughter or first daughter, whatever it is. Uh-huh. I know her from her Twitter handle, and now I know her from Facebook and her lovely children and lovely people that she surrounds herself with.
Yeah, I signed with her and Red Fox at the beginning of the year. I was with somebody prior to that who actually helped put the Faraway Friends project together. But yeah, I signed with Danielle at the beginning of the year, and I just love her. She's just great. I don't know what else to say about her. She really knows her stuff.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah, and she is just a fun, lovely person to work with. I just adore her, and I'm very, very lucky to be with her and with Red Fox.
She definitely represents herself well online. Like, you get a real sense of her personality, of that. I mean, I know, again, having talked to people such as yourself, I know that when you look for an agent, that you're looking for someone that you can have this relationship with, that can take care of your work, that it's not just who can get me the best deal or who has the best clients, or I don't even know what I'm trying to say in that way, that it really is who can help me become, you know, put forth my best self and my best work so that it can be ultimately in the hands of children. And I'm, you know, it's so nice to see someone like Danielle being the person that she is online, and then knowing that, oh wow, her clients must have this and more from her, because in that way she's actually working with you, with your work as well, not just saying the nice things she does on Twitter or on Facebook.
That is true. And yeah, I mean, there's other agents, they have the, you know, these mega connections and stuff like, but Danielle really helps develop your stories, your art, your style, helps you develop a voice.
Yeah.
So she really gets in there and you know, she tweaks things, but she's not like, I'll change it to this. She's like, you know, think about it this way. And, you know, she's very, so you're always learning. You're not just being told to do something. You're learning through her eyes, actually.
See, hearing you say that, and I feel like I've heard something like that mentioned before, but it just surprises me, but it's such a good thing to hear. Mm-hmm. But that you're working with an agent, but the attitude is that you're still learning, that it's not you have to be done and perfect and fantastic and whatever, but that this is a relationship where things are still worked on and still developed. And this is just the person that helps you get it to the next step. And I think you mentioned with Faraway Friends that it was a number of people that helped you get to publication, not just you finished it, you turned it in, and then it came out.
Right. Right. And Danielle, she just has this great way about her that, you're not afraid to send her something that's maybe halfway done. I mean, I know I have friends who have agents where they don't want to see anything until it's basically polished. And okay. then, but Danielle, you can send her things that are in the works or your just thoughts. And it was really funny when I first signed with Danielle, she said, well, send me a list of some story ideas that you kind of have written down or, you know, are thinking about. So I sat down and I typed it up. And it's like 3 hours later, I had almost 50 story ideas. Like, I'm like, oh, I have to stop now. This is like the War and Peace of story ideas.
You did Paibo Idmo in one sitting.
I know. I was like, oh, this is just crazy. And I know some are really, really bad. So I said, here they are, warts and all. And she actually went through every one and she picked out five and said, let's start working with these five and then we'll get these done and we'll go to the next five.
Oh, that's great. I mean, to know that, again, it's not even that. Well, let me back up if you don't mind. I'm going to ask a question that you're welcome to just redirect me if you're not comfortable saying it. I really want to be as polite as I can. But mm-hmm. you mentioned that you were with another agent. Mm-hmm. What caused you to seek a different representation? Was it perhaps that your interest just didn't line up, or you? I know that it's okay to leave and it's okay to find someone else, but just if you don't mind sharing a little bit about that experience with me, I'd appreciate it.
Oh, sure. I mean, she was really good. She knew the story ideas. She had connections, everything. I just felt that we kind of hit a wall and things were a little stagnant and I needed a change. I needed some, some fresh set of eyes.
Yeah, okay.
Probably a good way to put it. And the timing was just right to make the change. And I have to say it was very, very difficult. It weighed on me probably for at least a month, if not longer.
Before saying it or after leaving this other representation?
Before. Because it's a hard decision. Because
I would imagine. I mean, it's like breaking up with somebody or something, right?
It's exactly what it is. I mean, some other people asked me how it was. I said, well, you know, it's kind of like you date somebody for a couple years and then you realize, well, you know, this is just lovely person, everything, but it's just not the right person for me.
Okay.
And just because it's not the right person for me doesn't mean it's not the right person for other people.
Exactly.
So, mm-hmm. So that happened. And then I started talking to Danielle, and actually I have a couple of friends who are with Red Fox, Jennifer Bowers and my friend Julie, who's in my critique group. They actually kind of put the bug in Danielle's ear. It's like, you might want to take a look.
Wait, is it the Julie that I know?
It's probably the Julie, you know, Snapsy Julie.
It's Julie Velatko.
Yeah.
I love Julie, friend of the podcast.
Yeah, Julie's great. Yeah, she's in her critique group, so.
Look how you're all buddies. All of you kidlit people are always connected. I don't know why it ever surprises me, but it's always just exciting to know that one friend knows another. It's cool.
I mean, it really is. And what's the funny thing is that Danielle actually represents four or five of us in the main area.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But Jennifer and Julie kind of planted the seed in Danielle's ear. So I owe a big gratitude to the two of them.
Oh.
Because they helped get me in.
Hold on. I'm looking up one of my friends. I should just do it this way. I'm just gonna say this. One of my friends, I'm in a critique group as well, and it's wonderful, and it's I love it all, and people are good. But one of my good friends signed as well very recently with an agent, and it was. It was with Danielle, and it was one of those like, wait, are we talking about the same Danielle? We are, right? So I was just looking it up. But it's, I don't know. It's to me, it's weird. It's weird that it's a small world. I love that it is, but sometimes it's just kind of mind blowing that I guess it goes back to, and my word, if this isn't the banner we wave on this podcast, but how well everyone is connected and lifts everybody up. Every single person just loves everybody else. And if it's the idea that we're not all writing the same book, therefore we're not directly in competition with one another or whatever, or maybe just people are good. But I never thought I'd meet better people than these people that I know in the library world, which I think librarians are some of the greatest people on earth.
Oh, definitely.
And wouldn't you know it, that the Kidlit community is almost just mirroring the library community. No wonder we all get along so well, but really the people are just, you know, they're just wonderful, wonderful people through and through. No one seems to at all have any like ill will toward anyone else. It's really kind of a wonderful thing.
Well, yeah, I kind of think of the libraries and librarians as part of the Kidlit community. I don't think of it as separate. I think we're all, you know, we all have a common goal. And that's the kids to read a book.
Right. And you know, in the way that this is, I've definitely said this, so I'm sorry to be redundant, but in the way that we need you to write good books for these children, and then you need us to, you know, enjoy them enough to want to keep recommending them. And but that's, I think right there is probably where you're tapping at sort of that friendship and kinship that we all have, is that we fall in love with books. I know you do too, but I say that we librarians fall in love with books, and you see it. You see it in all of these amazing blog posts that, like, Margie over at Librarian's Quest writes these posts that are just beautiful love letters to picture books and the people behind them, and John Shu and Cynthia Olenese, and just everyone. You can just name on and on and on people that are sharing photos of the books they're reading and just talking about how much the book just moved them, and making mock Caldecott lists and doing all that. It's just when... I don't know. It's just the way that you're connecting is, I mean, it's art. It's admiring art. It's loving.
Uh-huh.
It's just loving that piece of art, whether it's the words being the art or the illustrations or just the book itself, the way it came together. It's such a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Yeah. And I think the Kidlit art community, I think it's a very humble community. It's kind of like, unlike, I was a graphic designer for many years, and that community was, you know, it was all about the individual and the awards and the recognition and, you know, advancing up the scale from designer to art director to creative director, all that. But I don't see that in the Kidlit art community. I think people are there to help each other as much as they can. And, you know, we kind of look out for one another, and somebody's down, we lift them up, and, you know, we're willing, you know, I share ideas with a bunch of people. I don't worry about anybody taking my idea, you know, and running and doing something with it, because I think everybody's very respectful of one another.
Well, I love being able to hop on, you know, it's funny that I do these presentations around the country where I talk about whatever, Twitter or library advocacy or whatever, but in particular about Twitter, I talk when I'm trying to get librarian friends and educators on about how it's okay to just lurk. It's okay to go on to Twitter and just look at things. It's fine. And that's totally what I do with your Kidlit art chats. I am such a voyeur in those chats, just watching you post. Every single person's like, this is what I'm working on. And then 40 people, including myself, we just get on and say, oh my word, that's so beautiful. I love that you're doing that. I can't wait to hear the story behind it. And it's just so fun to be part of community and do that. So I'm just going to say on recording that if anyone, you know, if you're around on Thursday nights, does it begin at 9? I think it begins at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard.
Right.
You Kidlit group are always talking about things that are very, you know, supportive of the illustrator community. It's often about what tools you're using or whatever you're using. But I also find that the conversation always goes down rabbit holes to talk about other people's art. So I always feel like, oh, I'm completely at home here, because I don't have to talk about what fountain pen I like to use or whatever, which is awesome that people do. But instead, Tracy Bishop, I love just hearing her talk about that kind of stuff. But it's fun just to go on and say, you know what, that thing you're making is really beautiful. And I mean, that's part of why I like doing this podcast too, is being able to have a platform where we get to say to you making the art, you know what, that's really beautiful work that you're doing. I don't know if you comprehend how nice it actually is that you're making this thing. I want to tell you over and over on Twitter or whatever. It's just nice to be able to go on and be fans of one another.
It's a big fan community. It's we have a lot of people that kind of lurk on our Thursday night chats, and we encourage the people who participate to, you know, to talk about what they're working on, to post samples, because I know editors and art directors are looking.
That's true.
And I know some people who have gotten work from the chats.
Oh, that's amazing. Do you, mm-hmm. are you part of, I know Deandra May also is like one of the sort of moderators or organizers, if you will. Are you also one of them? Do you,
yes.
do, so you actually help to determine what the topic will be each week that you'll talk about or moderate, but I would say direct the conversations. Yeah, that's, well, it's good. You, then let me compliment you directly that you have a really good thing going and it does make that. People outside of your community feel very welcome. I've always felt like it's a home there for me.
It is a home. And Renee Carrillo is also a part. She's a moderator as well.
Oh, see Renee. I like Renee.
Oh, Renee's great.
She's a good buddy of mine.
Yeah. Yeah. We did a workshop together a year ago at the New England conference. We had a lot of fun.
I should say by good buddy, I mean, she knows that I'm quite a fanboy of her art and she talks nice back to me when I say it. No, I know Renee through her work at Fable Vision, yes. because of the work I do with Fable Vision with Dot Day and things like that. And I don't know. She's just good people. Renee's good people.
She is good people. And Deandra. The three of us just click. And I guess the Kidlit Art Chat was run by a couple other people for a few years. And they kind of got burned out. And
yeah, of course.
It shut down for a year. And we're thinking, hey, you know what? Let's see if we can't revive it. And I think we're approaching our 2-year anniversary of bringing it back. Great. So.
Well, even better too to you know pass the reins off to someone else when it's time and not let mm-hmm. something like this die, but give someone else the opportunity to be in that place where they get to sort of steer the ship and keep encouraging yeah. people in that positive way.
Definitely.
So Russ, let me go back to your books because I do want to ask about what you're working on now. But I know also that you've done illustration for Capstone and for different companies mm-hmm. like that. When you do that as an illustrator, is that sort of like a work for hire thing or just what does it mean to illustrate for Capstone? Is it like a per job thing or do you get hired as an illustrator for them and you work for like a year or something? Like what does that mean?
With the Capstone book was it was per project.
Okay.
It was a one project deal. And, there was well, that was a couple of years ago. I'm trying to think. I think I've got an advance on it, which is usually when you do a picture book, you get an advance.
Oh, okay.
And then you get usually a royalty on top of that. And I'm just trying to think. The more I think about it, I think the Capstone book is more of a flat fee. So you just got paid a fee and there was no royalty or anything.
I'm aware of some people that have written like series nonfiction or have been a part of that. Mm-hmm. Again, mm-hmm. not having really had the opportunity to ask them a little bit more about what does it mean to do that. So that good to know that it was a per project thing. And then I know you've done other illustration work for other people. I didn't know if they all went through a publisher in that way or not. Cause because it's different with illustrators and authors that I know with authors, the publisher can buy the manuscript or the rights to the manuscript, but then,
right.
you know, the illustrator, I don't think it ever works the other way around where you're going to give them 30 drawings on what feels like a story and then have some dude write it for you or some woman write it for you. I don't think it works that way as far as I know.
That would be interesting to do the illustration.
Very interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and then have somebody write their story around what you did. Huh. You might be onto something new, though.
Something terrible. I'm not onto anything, no.
But the project I'm doing with Penguin Random House, it's a chapter book series called Puppy Pirates, written by Erin Saltersberg Downing.
Okay.
And she also wrote The Quirks, which Kelly Light illustrated.
I know The Quirks, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's a chapter book, and that was a flat fee per book.
And that you were contracted to do, like they said, okay, she's going to do 5 books, and we want you to illustrate all of them sort of thing?
Yes.
Okay, yep. Cool. Well, mm-hmm. that's good, because then that ensures consistency in illustration through the series, too.
Yes, yes. And actually, the first 2 books came out last Tuesday.
All right. More art in the world.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the stories are so funny. It's a group of course, puppy pirates who kind of get in all this mischief and they battle the cats and looking for bones on buried treasure and stuff. I'm not doing any justice by explaining it to you, but the stories are so funny. When I get the manuscripts, I look forward to reading them, and I'm usually cranking up. They're just
nice.
Some of the stuff that Aaron puts in there, it's like other little twists, a little play on words about what dogs would do, and as a pirate, you're just cranking up. So.
And they're illustrated novels, then? You're doing some interior illustration?
Yeah, I usually do anywhere from 20 to 26 interior black and white illustrations.
So do you then? Like they say, okay, we want 25-ish illustrations. Will you sort of, like, you read the manuscript and then you sort of make ideas for where the different illustrations could go? Like, oh, I could draw this here, draw that there. In a way that it would help, I don't know, sort of pace the story too. I could imagine you couldn't just have all of chapter 3 is going to have an illustration on every single page, but nothing anywhere else.
Well, I'm working with Jenny Chu. She's the designer at Random,
okay.
Penguin Random House. And what she does is she sends me a kind of a layout, and they have openings where they want the illustrations. So there's like some size requirements.
Like they've formatted the pages already. I can picture that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Which makes life a lot easier. And then they put like notes. So I kind of work around the notes. But if I come up with something different, I'll send them a second sketch. I may make notes like, hey, what if we did this and do this? And a lot of times they're like, hey, yeah, let's add that. So, you know, just adding little twists and stuff. So they allow me to kind of bring my own voice, or it's not so, you know, strict where it's like, okay, it has to be a puppy climbing, you know, up the mast. So, you know, we'll make things more playful and which what they really like.
Oh, fun. Well, that's great too, that you in a novel get to have a voice in the story too, or a contribution, a sort of hand in telling some of the story.
Yeah.
But cool to know that it comes that way too. I guess it makes sense that it would come that they've already formatted the manuscript to the number of pages they want, probably to the dimensions that they want. And then that you're working the illustration in that makes it a lot easier to visualize in my mind the way that works. I like that. Well, congratulations on that. How many books will Puppy Pirates have?
Well, I'm going to start the final art for the fourth book probably in the next couple of weeks, and there are going to be two more books after that.
Yay, 6 books. Congratulations.
I know. Yeah, it's exciting.
Cool. And then do you have any more picture books in the works? I'm sure you're writing, but...
Yes, Danielle, she has submitted a picture book series that we kind of developed together.
Hey, look at you, series of picture books. Well, good luck with that. That's awesome, Russ.
Thank you. Thank you.
What is it? Can you give a little bite about what it's about?
Well, the first book is kind of a tribute to my sister. I kind of thought of her as a little monster when we were growing up. So
I was waiting for the. What do you mean about your little sister?
So main character's name is Maximus Walker, and he has these not so real adventures. So the first one is kind of and also I kind of give a little homage to like old monster movies. Like the first one's a little kind of Creature of the Black Lagoon.
Nice. That's fun.
Yeah. So, yeah, he just kind of sees his sister as this little monster and she terrorizes him. And
cool.
Yeah.
Well, I hope it finds a home at a publisher. That sounds fun. Monsters are just always fun to play around with. I love the so many different ways that people have approached using monsters in books because of the way that you can sort of, I like the way that you can sort of hinge on being scary-ish in a picture book, but still okay. It's still fun, but still right. a little like, I don't know if I should trust the characters or trust the story. That's fun whenever that quality is introduced. So yay for that. Good luck with that, Russ.
Thank you. Monsters and robots. I just love it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we're in the same club here. I think I have yet to see monster robot hybrids though. That could be a thing for like book 9 of your massive picture book series.
Yeah, or we can make it the first book where I draw the pictures and then you write the story.
Oh, this could be.
Yeah.
let's just, knowing that it's never going to sell, let's just document that online. Okay, I've made 32 pictures for Matthew, and now he's going to attempt to tell a story where the words tell even more than the pictures describe. Oh, boy.
Hey, you never know until you try it.
Hey, you
as
know,
R.L.
so we all got to break into publishing somehow, right?
That's right. You know, as R.L. Stine says, never say no.
Not well. All right, never say no. On that note, Russ, I'd like to wrap things up with talking about kickball.
Okay.
All right, so here we go. I'm assembling an all-star kid-lit Dream Team kickball tournament, and I would love to know what one person you want on your team, alive or past, and why.
Okay, I thought about this. This is a hard one because there's so many great people I would want on my team, but I'm going to have to go with one. He's alive. I'm going to have to go with Sean Tan.
Wow, I haven't heard Sean Tan mentioned before. I love Sean Tan.
I have to go with him because he is just so different.
Australian, right?
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, he's just got a different voice. I'm a big fan of his artwork and his stories, but there's a sparseness to him.
Mm-hmm.
But yet there's an oddity and there's a twist and just the story itself and then the visuals. I just love that about him.
Yeah.
I would love to sit down with him and just pick his brain for an hour.
So never mind kickball. Let's talk.
Then go play kickball.
Yeah, Sean's great. I love most recently Rules of Summer was beautiful. I mean, every page, every illustration was a story to itself. Gorgeous book.
I know. Every time you turn a page, you're like, okay, what was he thinking to put this image with these words?
Oh, I know. It works so well.
And it works so well. I think he is brilliant. I think he's a master.
Yeah.
And he's going to go down as one of the all-time greats.
Mm, good call, Russ. Hey, it was wonderful talking to you on the podcast tonight. I'm so glad we finally got to connect.
Yes, maybe we'll run into each other at a conference or something like that. That would be wonderful.
I'll look forward to that. And best of luck with the upcoming year and with what's coming with these books you're submitting to publishers and also just with the school year with Faraway Friends.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I had a great time. I'm honored that you asked me to be part of this because I know you have, you had Kelly Light and a lot of other people who I love and admire. So I'm just very honored to be part of it. Thank you.
Let's Get Busy is recorded and produced by Matthew Winner in his library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. Theme music is by Blue Ducks. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, there are a ton of great episodes of Let's Get Busy archived and waiting for you at lgbpodcast.blogspot.com. And if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on the blog or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's Koko Sleep and I'll see you there.